Good afternoon. You're listening to Eye on the Valley right here on CIVL 101.7 FM broadcasting to the Fraser Valley, broadcasting from the University of the Fraser Valley Abbotsford campus on the traditional and unceded territory of the Stolo people. I have a very special guest for you, John Vissers, a community activist and an environmental activist in the Fraser Valley. Thank you for joining us. I have the great honor and privilege to introduce John Vissers, one of the well-recognized environmentalists and community activists in the Fraser Valley. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it. Your show is getting a lot of attention, and I'm just glad to be on it. Thanks.
Thank you. And I wanted to start off by asking what you've been up to in the Fraser Valley, because you do a lot of things. We were talking off air just briefly, and you were describing what you're doing. So I wanted to give you the opportunity to inform our listeners.
Sure. The 2 years of COVID have really restricted many of the things that we could be doing in the Fraser Valley, and in fact, beyond. A lot of the work that I do relies on volunteers participating and helping with, you know, habitat restoration projects and larger environmental actions as well. And now with the restrictions sort of slowly fading away, and we hope it's permanent, I'm ramping up certainly my activities and the activities of the different organizations that I work with. Everything from just local volunteer groups to national, international projects. So it's been a busy time the last couple of months, and I think it's going to be a very, very busy summer. There's much to do.
We were talking off air about your passion for recycling. And you know, we've had recycling programs in the Fraser Valley, just like everywhere else in the world. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to us your belief on recycling and how that affects the environment?
Yeah, there's what I want to talk about today is certainly bigger than the recycling issue, of course. But I would use the recycling problem as an example of what went wrong. Okay, however well intentioned. When we started the idea of recycling, many people remember that the three R's were reduce, reuse, and recycle. And of course, you know, industries and our consumer culture rejects the idea of reducing and reusing because they believe it's not that good for the economy, even though it's proven that it is, but the belief is that it's not good for the economy. And so the focus was on the third R, the least important one, which is recycling. The problem with that is that while it makes us all feel really, really good to think that we're doing something useful and positive, what it's done is shifted the attention away from producer responsibility and applied all of that, the guilt and the shame and all the work on the individual at the tail end of the cycle. And in the end, what we've learned is that much of our efforts in recycling are absolutely pointless. What we should have been doing from the start, of course, is focusing on producer responsibility and reducing the amount of waste and non-reusable packaging and so on, and the waste that's involved in marketing and consumerism. We should have been focusing on that, and we didn't. And the whole thing was a marketing campaign. A good example is the petrochemical industries that came up with the idea of the little triangles on the bottom of your plastic containers with the numbers on them, so that you could put the containers in different streams, and they could be more easily recycled. But in fact, what we learned, and I was one of the people who championed and promoted this for decades, but what we've learned in the last 5 or 10 years is that it's pointless. It's absolutely meaningless. More than 90% of plastics don't get recycled. Much of the products that we do recycle are actually downcycled. And if we're lucky, we get one more rotation out of the product before it turns into garbage. So there's really, really nothing has been achieved through recycling other than making us feel as if we're doing something good and useful. And that's not enough, because the garbage problem increases and increases exponentially all over the world. The plastics in the ocean, the microplastics in the Arctic, it's just outrageous that we've let it go this far. And no amount of recycling is going to get us out of that hole. So I wanted to use that as an example for an even bigger issue. And that, of course, is the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing now is that the oil and gas sector, and I don't call it natural gas anymore because, well, oil, we've got natural oil and natural coal, and gas is just another fossil fuel. There's nothing more or less natural about it than coal and oil. It's the same thing. It's a fossil fuel. So the oil and gas and coal industries around the world are not responding in any significant way to the, you know, the absolute necessity that we transition away from fossil fuels. And for good reason, they want to make as much money as they can. You can't blame them. But interestingly, about 20 years ago, British Petroleum, BP, one of the biggest producers on the planet, co-opted the term carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. And many of us have learned, you know, about the carbon footprint and done everything we possibly could to reduce our carbon footprint. And that's a part of the problem, is that it was a marketing campaign, really. They saw the term, they liked it. It was actually borrowed from Professor Bill Reese's ecological footprint concept from the 70s and 80s. And what it did was, just like in the plastics industries, you know, putting the numbers on in triangles on the bottom, what it did was it transferred the carbon footprint, transferred responsibility away from the industries, away from the producers, and onto individuals. And so millions of us started feeling guilty and concerned about our carbon footprint, and for good reason. There's nothing wrong with that. But we started thinking, well, what can we do to reduce our carbon footprint? Not thinking at all about, well, what about the producer? What about, you know, what about the oil and gas sector and the mining and the drilling and the methane emissions from the, you know, fracking? We never thought about any of that. All we thought was, what can we do to reduce our carbon footprint? And so we started changing light bulbs and drying our clothes, you know, without using dryers and all sorts of little things. And what we realized was that none of it is making any significant difference, because our entire global built environment and infrastructure is interconnected with the oil and gas industry. And so our own personal efforts become insignificant in the scheme of things. So what we've, and the other thing that the transition or the transfer of responsibility has achieved is that it only values those things that can be measured, like how much you drive your car or whether you fly or whether you eat meat. It doesn't measure the intangibles like activism and lobbying and the kinds of things that we do to try to change attitudes and lifestyles. So then it devalues those things, and people forget that those are much more useful in the long term than changing a light bulb. But it conveniently keeps the oil and gas sector out of trouble and allows them to continue doing exactly what they're doing. And it's a terrible problem. And I don't see any easy solution other than, of course, people becoming more action-oriented collectively.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to ask you about, because we saw the movement of Greta Thunberg mm-hmm. just before the pandemic spreading around the world, especially with young people. How do you think we can, how can activists like Greta and you in the Fraser Valley mm-hmm. Change the mind of consumers to be more active in climate change debate?
Well, It's not that complicated, and I'm very hopeful that we are going to be able to re-energize this mass movement, because that's the only thing. It's the only thing that's going to work. Greta Thunberg is a classic example. If Greta had just stayed home and and didn't eat meat, and changed her light bulbs and reduced her carbon footprint to almost zero, she would have been a very, very good person. But imagine what wouldn't have happened in the world had she not had the courage to stand up and start a movement. What she did was infinitely more valuable and had a much greater impact on the climate crisis than any amount of small personal actions. While the small personal actions are essential because they do help us and motivate us in terms of thinking about these sorts of things, they're not the solution. And so Greta is a classic example. I can use an example from here in Abbotsford from about 15 or 20 years ago. There was a gas power plant planned for just across the border in Whatcom County, and a massive, huge gas power plant. And of course, it would have not only would have had a gigantic carbon emissions problem, it was also going to pollute our airshed. And so we were able to get the entire city of Abbotsford, in fact, the whole Fraser Valley, galvanized in opposition. And thousands of people, I was organizing these rallies, and thousands of people came to the rallies. And it took us 5 years of court hearings and challenges and taking the fight down to Washington State. It took us 5 years, but we were able to stop a gigantic gas power plant from siting right on our border on the U.S. side. And so it was an international issue. What stopped it was collective action. And that's the only thing that would have stopped it. Nothing else would have stopped it. There would be a giant power plant there right now producing or burning gas and wheeling cheap electricity down to California had we not done this. But we stopped it and it worked. We can do the same with the oil and gas industries. There's a new concept right now, been around for about a year. Some of your listeners have probably listened or heard about it. Instead of a carbon footprint, we're starting to talk more and more about what's called a climate shadow. And the idea of a climate shadow is that everything we do has a consequence. If you cast a shadow right behind you of everything that you do, all your actions, and if you want to reduce the size of that shadow, it goes back far. It can go back, you know, even generations. And so the shift has to be much broader than, buying an electric car or changing a light bulb or a furnace. It has to be much bigger and broader than that. And so sometimes we're better off to focus our energies on collective action than we are on riding a bike twice a week. It's good. It's all good stuff. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm trying to do these things too, but sometimes we're better off to think about things like where do we invest our money, or where is our pension? If you have a pension, where is your pension funds invested? Surjeet, your university still invests in, oil and gas industries. The investment portfolios for big companies and for all sorts of groups like teachers funds just recently are divesting from oil and gas. Why is UFV not doing that? I'm astonished that they haven't stepped up. Even if it's just symbolic, it needs to be done. And if you can divest, if you can focus on where your donations go, if you're donating money, where are they going? Are they going to something sustainable? Are they going to something that's going to help reduce the carbon emissions problems around the world? Those are things that aren't measured in a carbon footprint. The neutralizing and reducing aspects of lobbying and joining organizations and supporting groups like EcoJustice, who are right now fighting against that, the oil, offshore oil exploration in Newfoundland. Those are the groups that we need to encourage and support. And so putting more energy into that is infinitely more useful, just like the Greta Thunbergs, than consuming ourselves with guilt and small actions at home. That's what we need to do. We're running out of time. Yeah. And if we're going to keep the world under, look at us right now, we're only at 1.1 degree warming since the beginning of the industrial age, and look at the consequences. We're going to almost, we are certainly going to go up to 1.5 or even 2, no matter what we do. So you can imagine the catastrophic problems that we're facing. But if we don't do anything and it goes up, say, 3 degrees, probably large parts of the world will be uninhabitable. And that's just insane. Why would we let that happen? But we have a short window of time left. And the only thing that's going to make a difference is collective action. That means lobbying. That means joining mass movements. That means just voting for people that are willing to stand up and make a difference. And none of those things can be measured, but they're much more important.
Could you describe to our listeners the oil pipeline that's running through Abbotsford right now?
Oh, yeah. I'm just so disappointed. We fought this thing for, the last 7 or 8 years. Well, there was a Trans Mountain pipeline, of course, that moves 300,000 barrels of oil a day, 300,000 barrels a day through Abbotsford and through the Fraser Valley to Burnaby, where it's loaded onto tankers and goes offshore. We fought a proposal and application to triple the size of that pipeline. In other words, go up to around close to 900,000 barrels a day, based on the climate consequences, the climate change consequences downstream. That means where the stuff gets burned. And we fought it in court and we lost. And in the ensuing year or two after that, the company couldn't see a business model for building the pipeline. And so they sold it to the Canadian government. And our government now owns it and is continuing the project. And it's already gone something like 100 or 200% over budget. It will probably cost something like $21 to $25 billion before it's finished. And we will never see that money back. That money is gone. And that's just the economics of it. The horror is that we are now poised to export the worst, dirtiest tar sands oil, the dirtiest oil on the planet for the international market. And it's just unconscionable. There's just no way we should be doing this, but we are. And now we're responsible. It's our pipeline. We own it as citizens. And yet here we are allowing this to happen. There's no business model for it. It makes no sense. It would take 50 years at least to break even. And by then there will be very little, if any, oil and gas being burned on the planet. There will be some, but not nearly as much as now. And so there's really no model for this thing to continue past even break even. There's no point. Plus, yeah, now we're also adding exploration for offshore oil in Newfoundland. It goes on and on. And this is our own Canadian government. This is our Liberal NDP government that's supporting and promoting this. How can we let that happen? How did we let that happen?
We'll be right back after these messages on CIVL.